Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Beth Mitchum. I'm the Vice President for the International Division of ASHS, and want to welcome all of you here. See a lot of familiar faces in the crowd. And it's my pleasure to introduce our invited guest speaker for the luncheon today, Dr. Sahara Moon Chapatin. And I'll tell you a little bit about her background and then how I came to know her. So she got her PhD in plant physiology from Harvard. I noticed she didn't put any dates on this, so I'll leave them out too. She over the years after she got her PhD, she did a lot of field work, international field work in places like Madagascar and Costa Rica and also here in the United States. And I got to know her when she worked for USAID, and her most recent post there was as the Deputy Assistant Administrator. So she had a very high-level position at USAID, and for me, as the Director of the Horticulture Innovation Lab, you know, of course, she was one of the senior leaders that helped to guide our program at USAID. And I always enjoyed interacting with her there, and with her strong science background, and also a good manager and leader. I appreciated working with her quite a lot. But now, just recently, I guess, was it not even a year ago, 6 months ago, she transitioned to a new position, still here in Washington, D.C., but she's now the executive director of the U.S. Botanic Garden. And I know ASHS had several tours to the Botanic Garden this week. So many of our members got to enjoy that beautiful facility. So it's really my great pleasure to have her come and speak. I was really pleased that she accepted the invitation to talk not only about her international work, but kind of her career development and how she got to where she is. And I think she's going to talk a little bit about how all this comes together with these different positions. So please join me on the podium here.
Great. Well, good afternoon. It's great to be here. You can all hear me okay? Good. So, like Beth said, I'm going to be just giving you sort of some stories about different things I've done throughout my career, trying to tie it a little bit together as a plant lover, a tree lover, and a food and agriculture lover. You'll also be kind of getting a tour through photography technology as we go. So we'll be starting back in the era of old print sort of film photos that probably got a little washed out as they went through various x-ray machines around the world. So bear with me. The photos get much better towards the end because I didn't take them. So I have always had a love of high places, of trees. I used to do some trapeze work, love being up on the top of tall buildings. And so I did some work earlier in my career before I went to grad school, doing some canopy biology work, and I really thought I would have this lifetime of just working in the treetop. I'd be one of those people like François Hallé with his raft sitting on top of the trees. And so this is me in Madagascar getting to do that during grad school. But as you'll see, I actually end up taking some different turns and haven't really spent my life in the trees, though someday maybe I will have a treehouse and I can just do that. I spent a lot of time in Madagascar working on baobab trees. This is Adansonia grandidieri, one of the very notable picturesque Malagasy species. Some of you may know there are 8 species of baobabs in the world. We're all very familiar with the one from Africa, digitata. I do not have a photo of that one in my slide deck. This is the famous Alley of the Baobabs, which we had to drive through to get to my field site, which was the Kirindi Forest near Morondava on the west coast of Madagascar. Another beautiful baobab tree they had there, Adansonia rubrostipa, with his wonderful little round fruit. Leafless during the dry season, beautiful leaves during the wet season, and I think as many of you know, baobabs have these big fat trunks, and they live in these dry arid climates, and so my research was focused on why are baobab trees so fat. I will tell you the answer to that question in a few slides, but really wanted to kind of get an understanding of how these trees live in the dry forest climate and what are they doing with all this water in their fat trunks. As you'll see, the baobab trees in Madagascar are taller and not quite as fat as the ones in Africa. They're actually forest trees. You think of baobabs as being out in the savanna in Africa. In Madagascar, they are often found in more or less dense dry forest as canopy emergence. Madagascariensis, another one of the species. Perrieri. This one is quite threatened. There's only really a handful of trees in the botanical sense, a handful, probably maybe a couple hundred if we're lucky, in northern Madagascar. And Suarezensis, a way found up in the north, often growing right up along the coastline. Beautiful, phenomenal trees, and I felt so fortunate to spend a few years of my life going back and forth to Madagascar to really look into this question of what's up with these crazy trees. Adansonia za, also a species in the Kerindi Forest where I was doing some work. This is a photo of the Kerindi Forest looking out from a baobab tree. The leaves you see at the top are the baobab tree that I'm sitting in. As you can see, one off in the distance that's kind of glowing yellow is another baobab tree. So they just kind of stick up above the forest, and they have these massive trunks going down. And like most of the trees around them, they're leafless in the dry season. I brought my own lab with me. This is it came across the ocean, or I flew across, in many huge trunks. And if you've ever tried to go through airport security with equipment, as I'm sure many of you have, you'll know what it's like to show up at an airport check-in counter with six large trunks on your trolley and then being like, that's too much luggage. You're like, I know, we'll get through this. So I had a lab set up. We were out in the forest, a little tap for running water, some solar panels, and that was about it. So it was really interesting to try to do this kind of physiology work in that space. Our field site was 30 kilometers down a dirt road. In the dry season, it was pretty easy to get to. In the rainy season, you can't really see where the road is here, and that's why these men are standing on the side of the road to help this truck get through, so the truck knows how not to veer off into the lake that's right next to the road, and it's not clear there's really much of a difference between the two. And we all camped in little tents, so this was my home while I was living in the forest. The hammock, I had many, many nice hours in the hammock when I wasn't lugging stuff around up and down the trees. But the work I was doing involved monitoring water relations of these trees, looking at some biomechanics work. I had sap flow probes. This is at the top of the tree, so a lot of climbing up and down with batteries and pieces of equipment and trying to battle the humidity in the rainy season, which is when really everything was happening. And I'll just cut to the chase on... the answer to why are baobab trees so fat is really so they don't fall over. And that was my 6 years summed up in a punchline. And the sort of textbooks, not a textbook, the general accepted idea on what baobab trees are doing is that they're storing water to get through the dry season. They're in this very, very dry, arid climate, and they need that stored water in their trunk. But when anyone who really understands how a plant work, if you stop and think about it for a second, the rainy season is when they've got leaves. There's actually quite a bit of water around. And other than right at the beginning of the rainy, before the rainy season when they flush their new leaves, they're not really relying on that stored water at all. And in fact, if you get a bit of a dry period during the rainy season, they shut down completely, no photosynthesis, no transpiration, and they just wait for the rain. And as soon as it rains, boom, they're sucking up that water with their very shallow roots. And in fact, their wood is quite soft and it's a bit the consistency, if you think about a carrot and styrofoam and you cross those together, that's what the wood is like on the inside of some of these baobabs. And it's not clear that you could really remove much of that water without affecting the structural integrity of the tree. And in fact, my research showed that they are no more overbuilt than any other tree. If you take into account the buckling height of a tree and the fact that most trees are obviously overbuilt to a certain extent to withstand storms and such, they're no more overbuilt than any other tree. They're just a different way of building a tree made out of a different kind of wood. So I spent a lot of time up in these trees, sometimes dawn to dusk, doing stomatal conductance measurements. I had a lot of company. This is a shifak lemur eating a baobab flower bud. The little thing over here is a baobab flower. The forkmark lemur, they came around at night. It's not clear how much pollinating they were doing. As you can see, the stigma is way over here. So they're probably mostly thieving nectar, but some of them got in there and probably got some pollen on them too. The fulvous lemur, this one has twins, so it's just kind of a sweet little picture. And this is an aerial view of the Kerindi Forest. I mentioned it was in the tropical dry forest of Madagascar when I was there in the early 2000s. It was already a rapidly disappearing habitat. I'm sure that now if I were to go today, I would find even less of this. So this is an aerial photo flying in. As far as I could tell, this was the border of the Corindi Forest where I was working, and as you can see, it's rapidly being converted to other uses, mostly farmland. But if you look closely, and it's not a great photo, if you look closely, you can see the little baobabs speckled throughout the landscape. The baobabs are left behind when the forest is cleared, mostly because it's too hard to cut them down. They have this very, very thick bark, fibrous bark around that soft wood, and if you were to cut them down, you couldn't do anything with the wood anyway, and so you might as well leave them up to provide a bit of shade for animals, and they are do have a special significance to the Malagasy, so they're also left for cultural reasons. The Alley of the Baobabs, if anyone's ever been there or seen pictures, often has this water in the foreground during the rainy season, and I've just been talking about how these are trees designed for growing in really arid climates, and that land use is also changing the water patterns around the trees, and this is in the distance a Chinese sugar field. There's a big sugarcane operation there, and the outflow from that was sort of flooding this very picturesque landscape near Morindab. And in fact, one of the things I got to do my last year there was really pull together some of the key players around there and try to have a conversation around the fact that the baobab trees in this area were slowly dying, likely due to their roots being flooded for a large part of the year, which is not the situation they normally would have encountered in the forest. And in fact, if you look out over this landscape, this would have once been tropical dry forest with the baobabs sticking out from the top, and now it's this sort of open agricultural environment. So that was obviously going to be a long conversation in the making, but I understand that there has been some further development in that area as far as, I think, really trying to protect this particular environment, the Alley of the Baobabs and the surrounding fields. But I know habitat loss in Madagascar continues to be a major issue. This is a tree stump I saw. I don't know how this tree died, but we were seeing more and more of these throughout that landscape. More recently, some of you may have seen, I don't know if this ever happened to you, in your field of study, someone publishes a paper that gets a lot of attention and 30 different people send you the same article or different versions of the article. So this happened to me a little while ago. There was this brief communication in Nature about the demise of the largest and oldest African baobabs, and then pretty much everyone I knew sent me from their local paper or some coverage of it. It really got a lot of note because these are... everyone knows what the baobab tree is. They know that they're very, very old, and a team was studying the fact, was trying to look into how old they were using carbon dating. You can't really do regular cores and count the rings as you could on other trees. And over the course of their study, they found that the largest of these trees in Africa were actually just dying catastrophically. And the authors surmised this is due to climate change. They didn't have a lot of supporting evidence in that respect, but they had some reason to believe it was due to climate change. And actually, in some cases noted that there was drought and the water content of the tree was greatly reduced in some of the trees that had just died. And so on some level, I felt like, well, this kind of supported some of the work I was doing in the sense that during a very long drought, these trees are not actually able to survive. The water is coming out of their stem and they're probably collapsing due to just insufficient water content and ability to hold up their own massive, massive weight. So I think this remains to be seen how widespread this is. I don't know if this is happening in Madagascar as well, or really what is the exact cause of the death, but it certainly is alarming, and I also just found it quite sad because these are really beautiful trees. So I was in Madagascar for a little while. A few jokes later, all the guidebooks say that the locals tap the trees for drinking water, which is not true because there's nothing you can do by tapping a tree. But my colleague and I stuck a faucet. We had a little cup hanging off of this, and the tourists who came through the forest are now firmly convinced, I'm sure, that the locals tap the trees for water. I couldn't resist. He was on a trip, and I got this in town and screwed it in. When he came back, he was like, what's going on? We had a few beers along the way, as anyone does when you're doing field work in Madagascar, and then I decided to do a little detour. I was wrapping up at the end of grad school and really, I think, partly influenced by what I'd seen in the field in Madagascar. Really this intersection of this beautiful natural area with these amazing species, the lemurs and these trees that you don't find anywhere else in the world, really up against some of the most severe poverty in the world. And often, you know, our field assistants and the students would often run into poachers in the forest, and you think, how could these people, you know, eat a lemur? And, well, you can eat a lemur when your kids have nothing to eat and you're growing rice, and that's really all you can kind of rice and a few peanuts scratch out of this land. And so I think that really inspired me to think, well, how can I take what I did and my training and really do something more focused on society and the intersection of science and society. So I found myself coming to Washington. I did a AAAS fellowship at USAID. And I didn't really know where I was going to head in this development direction, but I wanted to do something in agriculture and science at USAID. And I found myself doing a lot of amazing things. This is rural Bangladesh, so I spent the next few years pulling together this amazing project called the Cereal Systems Initiative for South Asia, which worked across the Indo-Gangetic Plains, introducing and working with farmers and local institutions to really change how agriculture is done across the rice wheat systems of South Asia, bringing in resource-conserving technologies, labor-saving, water-saving, electricity-saving, and really trying to diversify incomes through introduction of other crops. My first introduction to Bangladesh was Dhaka, which is this big, I'll just say a big horrible city. It's just packed, it's dirty, it's just, it's really hard to be there. And then you get out into southern Bangladesh, into the rural areas, and I just, it's one of the more beautiful places I've ever been. Just wonderful landscapes, wonderful people, and really resourceful, ingenious people. And so this was repeated across South Asia. We were doing things that were very simple, like sowing wheat into the residue of rice fields with zero tillage, so you can actually save a few weeks by not having to till the soil. You can get your wheat in earlier. You avoid that terminal heat stress at the end of the growing season for wheat, and you can really increase yields with a very simple and labor-saving technology. So things like that, trying to introduce new crops, new rotations, working a lot with the farmers. This is in India, just really amazing experiences and a real chance to kind of think about how a background in science and plant science can be applied towards development and some of the really amazing, and really thinking about how do you have local impact through this? How are you not just bringing in new technologies and trying to change things up, but how are you really learning from the farmers that you're working with to try to really transform, because that's what needs to happen in the Indo-Gangetic Plains and really probably in a lot of rural areas in the world, is really transform how agriculture is done to introduce new technologies, but also to adapt to a changing climate. We were very focused on increasing temperatures, which is going to have a huge impact on wheat yields in the Indo-Gangetic Plains and water availability. Really thinking about diversifying. This is a trial of sunflower in Bangladesh, trying to see if there's other crops that could come into this rotation. And, of course, a lot of working with farmers. So in the course of starting up this project, we also, the U.S. government was getting ready to launch a new initiative, Feed the Future. Many of you have probably heard of this. It was the U.S. government's Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative. It has since become, it was initially a presidential initiative, has since become really a whole of government when it was Congress passed the Global Food Security Act a couple years ago and really signaled its intent that it was also a congressional priority to be engaged in food security and development around the world. And one of the things that Feed the Future did was recognize that in order to truly have an impact and to work with farmers around the world, you needed to work with both men and women in the places where we're working. And some of my earliest experiences in Bangladesh, I actually spent my first trip there really just tallying up the people that I'd met. And I think by the end of my trip, I had actually, you know, met and probably shook hands with and been introduced to somewhere between 100 and 150 men and about 5 to 10 women. And that, to me, felt like a real it was a bit of a disconnect, and it wasn't really connecting to how we know that development needs to happen and to what I was seeing in the field and the farmers and the people who are out there. And so I think Feed the Future, one of its really signature developments was taking a very deliberate approach to ensuring that we were working with women and men in the field. And so my early days, I would go to a training, and I would see a room full of men very much wanting to learn, very much enthusiastic about what they're learning, but that room needed to be diversified, obviously, and towards the end of, you know, I kind of was visiting this project for several years, and as we transitioned to Feed the Future and really held our partners accountable to very much bring women and men to the conversations, it was incredibly gratifying to see, to go out to the field and to encounter women's groups and people and entire, you know, couple hundred women all there to learn, and you know, they weren't shy. They wanted to learn the machinery. They were often, especially in Nepal where we worked quite a bit, they were often the sole breadwinner or the one in the farm, because the men were off working in the Gulf, and so they were in charge of their farm and running their operation, and they were willing and ready to take on all the various operations of the farm. Another thing that Feed the Future did, which I found very I was very excited to be a part of, is its focus on nutrition and recognizing that simply more calories obviously is not going to do the trick, that you needed to both diversify incomes but also diversify diets to address the many of the severe cases of undernutrition in many of these countries where we're working. So I had a chance to go to Rwanda. This is Rwanda, a phenomenal country, just amazing to see the energy that people are really putting into developing their country there. for one of the innovation labs. You all know Beth Mitchum is director of the Horticulture Innovation Lab. When I left AAID, I don't know what the count is now. When I left USAID, we had 24 innovation labs in all the different many subjects related to agriculture and food security and nutrition. This is the Legume Innovation Lab, had one of their meetings there, and so we got a chance to get out in the field and see the work they were doing, introducing new bean varieties into Rwanda. Just amazing agriculturally, so many different things going on. And they were introducing, this is not the most attractive photo, but it is a field of climbing beans, and we got to visit, have a sort of farmer day where people were coming in to see the different beans, and just super, super exciting, and really the work around thinking about legumes and their role in the agricultural system and how important they are with respect to nutrition, with respect to environmental sustainability, but also with respect to gender. Legumes are often one of the crops that the women will grow, and it's often a way for women to generate income that they often the income in a family will be controlled by whomever generates, whether it's the man or the woman in the household. And so having a crop that women can use to generate income is vastly important. But also women are often still the ones making decisions about what people eat in the household and how they eat it and when. And so giving women the ability to grow a very nutritious crop that can both be profitable and nutritious was hugely important. Horticulture was also a very important area for us, again, given both the income generating and the nutrition aspects. This is a small drip irrigation system in Nepal that we visited way, way up in the mountains, this adorable little farm, and they were trying out different ways of integrated pest management and drip irrigation, which was super cool to see. I also got to spend quite a bit of time, actually, what I was really brought in to do from the get-go was to be on the biotechnology portfolio, and USAID had and still has a fairly robust portfolio in both developing genetically engineered crops that are suitable for smallholder farmers around the world and also really working with governments and scientists and others to build up their ability to make informed decisions and policy around genetically engineered crops. So we had a number of crops in the pipeline. This is a cassava field in Uganda. There were two different trials going on here. One was for brown streak disease and the other for cassava mosaic disease, both of which really decimate farmers' fields. And the genetically engineered varieties that they're trialing are virus resistant and were showing significant promise in potentially being a tool that a farmer could use to protect themselves against this virus, which you can see really does a number on the plant. And the genetically engineered version was looking pretty nice. Obviously still in the trial stage, so quite a bit more work to do on coming up with a product that could be released to farmers. Another one is eggplant. Many of you have probably heard about BT eggplant, which was released in Bangladesh. USAID had long involvement with that project, and we were really thrilled to finally see it released. I believe it's now in the seed multiplication stage, and farmers are actually doing that in the field. Eggplant feels like a bit of a peripheral crop here in the United States, the hugely important vegetable crop in South Asia. Very, really quite nutritious, but tremendous amounts of pesticides are applied to it to address the fruit and shoot borer, which once it gets in to the stem or the fruit, there's really not much you can do about it with pesticides, which means the farmers are applying multiple times a week, sometimes up until the day of harvest. And anecdotally, you'll hear that eggplant farmers won't even eat their own crop because they know how much pesticide they're putting on it. And there's a high incidence of pesticide poisoning, particularly among children in the farm space. So really great to see this technology. You've got the fruit shoot borer infested eggplant on the left, the BT eggplant on the right. Finally seeing the light of day in Bangladesh. It was unfortunately stopped in India, and I think it's still pending in the Philippines. We'll see where this goes. But it was exciting to see really the first food crop in the developing world that was released publicly and was developed by a public institution in a partnership with a company. And it'll be interesting to see where else that goes. Another one we worked on, again, a public-private partnership with Arcadia Biosciences, a small company in California, was the Noriko rice, and they were calling it the newest rice, so nitrogen-efficient, water-efficient, salt-tolerant rice. And so they had done this by introducing some genes for those traits, and we're trialing various combinations of those in both Africa and India. So another one, still a lot of these are all in product development, but we were incredibly pleased just to see these actually getting to field trial stage. So many times you hear about all these cool, promising technologies, they never really never leave the lab. And through the work we were doing on the biosafety side and helping governments set up a regulatory structure, you can't have a field trial if there's no one to submit your dossier to request permission for a field trial. And so just the basics of establishing that organization, the biosafety committee or whatever it may be, such that you can put forward an application and then you can actually get your application approved and you can proceed to field trial stage, felt like a huge milestone. And it was, I mean, Uganda at one point, I think we had like 8 or 10 different crops through, and that wasn't just us, the Gates Foundation and others were putting things through that same system that we helped set up. Really impressive to have that many crops moving through the pipeline. So I did get to do a little fun stuff along the way. Our latest, that meeting we had in Nepal about 4 years ago, I got to do a side trip up to the Annapurna mountain range, which was just phenomenal. This was this adorable little school with this wonderful view, and if I could send my kids to a school like that someday, it would be amazing. I also got to see some amazing plants along the way, which in a way was sort of, you know, I didn't know I'd be taking an orchid photo and later using that in a talk as I was the director of a botanic garden. But I spent 11 years at USAID, and then I learned that the position of the executive director of the U.S. Botanic Garden had opened up, and it felt like something I should take a stab at coming back to my plant roots. I was loving the work I was doing at USAID, always a little sad at having left my plant world behind, and so I found a way to make my way back to the plant world. So we're now, I'm at the United States Botanic Garden, which is just down the mall, the other end of the mall from USAID. It's the oldest public garden in the United States. It was chartered in 1820 by Congress. And our mission is to educate the public about the importance of plants, whether it's the economic importance, therapeutic, cultural, aesthetic importance, horticultural importance. And we do that through many, many different ways. But one of the ways we do that, before I tell you that, I'll show you some pretty pictures. So back to, you know, we had an orchid show here this spring, which was just absolutely phenomenal. And we filled up our main garden court with orchids and the rest of the conservatory as well. So if you didn't make it on the tour and you have a chance to pop over there, you definitely should. It's beautiful. This orchid show is not up right now, but there are still orchids in the garden. When I miss my tropical forest, I can walk into our conservatory and just bask in the tropics. It's really quite lovely. I spend most of my time in my office across the street. I don't want to suggest that I get to do my work from this little catwalk up here in the canopy. It'd be great if I could just sit there with my laptop and do my thing, but the humidity would probably do a number on it. So I mostly sit in my office, but it's amazing to be part of this wonderful institution. But one of the cool things about how we educate the public about plants is through agriculture. And many people today, especially in urban areas, don't really know where their food comes from, as you all probably know very well. But they're very excited about it and they want to know. And so agriculture is a way to help communicate to people about plants and the role that plants play in our world, whether it's environmental or for our food or economically. So just across the street from the conservatory, we have Bartholdi Park, which has this great kitchen garden in it. And right now, as you can see, there's corn growing in it, which is kind of cool. A lot of other vegetables. We let the vegetables grow through their full course of development. So we let the lettuce all go to seed so people can really understand what that plant is like and how it goes through its life cycle. We have lots of educational things going on. So here, the impact that we're having is really quite local in some way. I mean, we have 1 million visitors come through every year, so I would say our impact is definitely national and international. But we make a concerted effort to bring in local school children who can work in the kitchen garden, learn about environmental science and plant science throughout the garden, and really just, you know, these are kids who've been living in a city their whole life and are blown away to spend some time in the outdoors, even if it's this little tiny pocket of outdoors in the middle of Washington right at the base of the Capitol. We also have programming with veterans. This is, we're going to be this September doing a program called Arm to Urban Farm, where we will be doing a training for veterans who want to transition into agriculture as a career in the urban environment. We do horticulture therapy with active duty veterans or active duty military. And we have also taken, this is under my predecessor, Arnobi. He kind of got us back into the international collecting world, which really our roots harken back to the Wilkes expedition, where an expedition was sent out to canvas and collect plants from around the world and bring them back to the United States, and that's what formed the basis of our collections and our institution. And now we're doing that again in the modern era, which is super exciting. Here's our curator, Bill McLaughlin, who recently went on a collecting trip to the Philippines and actually discovered a new species of Amorphophallus, which is very exciting. I'll just put in a plug for a meeting we're having next April in Des Moines, which is designed to bring together the agricultural research community and the botanic garden community, and to really think about how we can strengthen that connection and educate the public better about horticultural research and botanic gardens and agriculture. So you're all welcome to join us. I can happy to send the info around if that's of interest to anybody. And that's pretty much all I had to say. I'm happy to take any questions or go back if you want to look at one of those pictures again or just sit there and, like, you know, stare at the trees or whatever. But thanks a lot. The official current status, and again, let me think, as of last summer, that's the last time I was current. I was on maternity leave and then I started this new job, so I will just say, so there may have been something happened last summer that I'm not aware of, but as of last summer, it was still under a moratorium. In India, the BT eggplant had been through the review of the committees that review safety of genetically engineered crops. It had been recommended for release or approved for release by these committees, in fact, and the then environment minister at the time put a moratorium in place saying he wanted more time to reach out to the public and get more information, but that was effectively, it was seen as a way of him putting a stop to this because it had been through all the approvals, and it was not even clear that he really had the authority to do that, but he did it, and it happened, so effectively he did. He then did a series of public consultations, or his ministry did a series of public consultations around the country, which were really taken over by the anti-GMO groups, the Greenpeace and others, and was not really a forum for scientists and the public to communicate. So those forums weren't seen as being particularly useful in the communication sense. And then that moratorium has just stayed in place, and nothing has happened officially. Unofficially, I've heard that when you release a crop in Bangladesh, obviously there's no real way to stop it from coming across the border. So it's very likely it will show up in India at some point if it hasn't already. If it does do that, it will probably be because farmers in India want the technology and will just go to Bangladesh and get it. So if it happens that way, and I'm not endorsing it or saying it will or won't, but if it were to happen that way, it would likely be a farmer-driven effort because they see the value in the technology. And my understanding was that when it was ready for release in India, the farmers were extremely enthusiastic about it. They're the ones facing the heavy losses to the pest, so they're the ones seeing the yield reductions, and they're the ones who are having to apply these pesticides with very little to no protection and you know, usually using off-label pesticides and so forth. But you're right, there is quite a bit of opposition, so I don't know what will happen. Potentially, based on the experience they see in Bangladesh, if it's a positive experience, perhaps in India they may come around and choose to release it. I know there's also a lot of misinformation around the experience with BT cotton in India, which... most of the issues that have arisen have not really been about the technology or its efficacy. It's really been about the politics of how people have engaged with companies and set prices and so forth. And in fact, you mentioned the suicides. Some folks at IFRI, the International Food Policy Research Institute, did a really nice study and actually were able to show that, tragic as the farmer suicides may have been, they were not directly attributable to BT cotton or any efficacy of the technology. And it really came down more to just the economics of being a farmer in some of these places in rural India and the way that, you know, when you want to get loans, the high interest rates and your ability to pay them off, and really just the economics of being a small farmer in India, whether you're growing BT cotton or regular cotton, is extraordinarily challenging. So I would say, even though there's a lot being said about the experience of BT cotton in India, for many farmers it was actually a very good experience, one in which they were able to make a greater profit because of access to that technology.
In the development sector about involving women, a group that clearly wanted to be involved but weren't involved initially, and how much progress had been made with that. What about groups that may not necessarily want to be involved, like youth, for instance?
Yes.
Maybe they don't want to be involved, but there's good reasons why we should try to get them involved.
No, you're absolutely right. And so one of the areas that Feed the Future was doing a lot more in, just as, even as I left, was in engaging youth. And I think recognizing that youth don't want to be involved in the agriculture of their parents and the sort of drudgery that they saw, and the fact that, you know, like in India, you can work and work and work and put everything you've got into it and still come out behind. So they don't want to be involved in that. But what we did find is that youth are excited about agriculture and do want to be involved in some form of agriculture. And so it's often the youth that will be most receptive to a new technology or to other types of entrepreneurial activities taking place in the agriculture space, whether it's food processing or providing data to farmers or some other aspect of the agricultural value chain. It doesn't always have to be in the production agriculture. And so we were recognizing the tremendous opportunity there, and also the fact that you have this enormous demographic situation in so many countries where you have so many youth entering the workforce. There's no jobs for them, and agriculture is not seen by many of those as a winning proposition. And so really we were thinking, we actually, as I left, we're just in the process of hiring a youth advisor. We were really thinking about how you can reach out to and engage those youth and not make it a false promise, not, you know, we're going to get you all excited about agriculture, and then they're going to find themselves in the same situation their parents were, but really delivering a new type of agriculture that would be meaningful, would provide meaningful employment and a higher level. So, you know, thinking about educated youth being engaged in agriculture as opposed to subsistence farming, for example. So yeah, our education programs run the gamut from occasional lectures where we invite someone in to speak to really any aspect of plants. It could be, we do a lot on art. We have a lot of art workshops, people, botanical illustrators coming in to demonstrate their techniques, all the way through to really understanding the interactions of plants with their environment, pollinators and insects and the ecosystem services that plants play. We have children's programs, things called Sprouts and Seedlings, where children will come in every one day a week for a month and really have a hands-on activity where they're learning about plant science. My 3-year-old did it this spring, and he was like over the moon. School groups are coming in constantly, and so we'll set up an interactive activity for that school group where they'll learn something about orchid pollination, or they'll learn about chocolate, and that we have a chocolate tree in the garden. And we, I didn't have any of those photos in here, but we have a huge collection of plants that are economically important. And so when you first walk into the garden, in the garden court, you can see a chocolate tree, you can see a coffee tree, you can see a papaya tree. And so really making that connection for the kids about a food they all love, which is chocolate, and understanding that the biology of it, how it has to get pollinated, how the, you know, and then the sort of value chain of chocolate, how the farmers grow it, and how the beans are processed and turned into chocolate. So we really try to kind of bring people in through a story that they can relate to about plants. I mentioned the horticulture therapy and also the sort of the urban agriculture training. We bring a lot of school groups through the kitchen garden to really understand sort of where food comes from and how it's grown. We have a signature program that is run in the summer called the Hands-On Plant Science, where it's an immersive experience for children who often will get to go on a field trip somewhere and spend an hour or two somewhere. These are community groups who will bring the kids that they're working with that summer in for essentially an entire week at the garden, and they will work their way through a series of stations on basically hands-on plant science, where they learn about the environment and about plant science in a way that's very tangible. And for most of these kids, that's going to be like the most time they've ever spent in an outdoor setting in a row in their lives, because they're, you know, these are from Title I schools in Washington, D.C., and in really, really urban environments. We have a lot of adult programming. Some of it happens in the evenings. People can, you know, we had a program this spring on cocktails and the plants that go into making cocktails. and let me think what else. We do a lot of work just in interpreting the plants we have in our space, particularly in our outdoor space. We have a national garden, which has within it a regional garden, which highlights native plants of the Mid-Atlantic region. So really a chance for people to understand what the plant life, the ecosystems in this area are like. We have a little wetland area and native trees and shrubs. In our Bartholdi Park, we recently renovated one of our outdoor spaces according to the site's standards. This is a set of standards we actually co-developed with some other partners. On sustainable landscapes. So it's effectively, if you've heard of a green LEED building, it's the same idea. It's those standards in an outdoor landscape. And so we renovated this park according to these standards, take into account tenets like reusing materials on site, ensuring that all the storm water flows into our rain gardens, making it a place where people can really come and interact with the outdoor world, making it highly accessible to all kinds of people. It's across the street from a memorial for the Veterans Disabled for Life Memorial, so it's really a space where we'd like to be welcoming to people of different abilities. And so we use that space as a way to help people understand what it means to be a sustainable landscape and also what aspects of the sustainable landscape they could bring into their home gardens. Yes. So millennials is a, I'm trying to think, at USAID we were working a lot with millennials, but I don't think they would have called themselves millennials, once you've hit 25, you're probably an established family person and a farmer in a lot of the countries we're working. Here in the U.S., at the U.S. Botanic Garden, and I'm looking over my colleague Devin, who's joined me, Devin Dotson, our communications director. Yes, and I think a lot of our programming now, and really as we think about food and agriculture, I think that's a way in which we are engaging, particularly with urban millennials, not just youth, but millennials, who are very interested to know both where their food comes from, but also are interested in the process of making food and interested in thinking about their food and its sustainability. And so that's been a very effective way for us to reach out to that group.
So you use electronic media too?
Sorry?
You use electronic media.
We do. Do you want to speak to that, Devin?
Sure. So we did launch for the first time ever on social media 2 years ago, actually 3 years ago now. Right after I joined the garden, they never used social media at all. And really, in addition to just posting photos of pretty plants and letters in bloom, I made a point of having a community ag theme and economic theme throughout some of our posts. Really talk about this is a plant that's giving us everything from chocolate, which is much more kind of sexy and accessible, to tomatillos or potatoes or corn. And so some of the photos that she used today, even of our kitchen garden, are photos that I specifically took, talk about raising corn. And so then we go through the whole process, we're talking about what does agriculture mean in the country, the United States, and raising different agricultural commodity crops and stuff. And so we've used a few of the tools that seem to be most active with the millennial group, even using things like Facebook Live, which grabs more attention and more eyeballs than even just a static post, and pointedly using those tools to reach out to that demographic, which is a little hard sometimes to get through the doors of what they might see as maybe a grandmotherly place, a kindergarten. But we've combined social media also with a new kind of specific programming focus, applying things like the ongoing cocktail series where we'll bring in and we'll talk just about vermouth or just about a specific alcohol potentially, and then how does all the plants come to play that bring us those products. And that is really a series, and there's others like that we're targeting for the millennial audience. And we're filling up every time. It's a new series we just started about a year ago, but we are actively pursuing those targets for them.
Mm-hmm. Any other
questions?
Right here.
You mentioned getting more youth involved, more educated youth involved in agriculture. Mm-hmm. And our work in horticulture is a nation level work for the university. And one of the things I feel like you find a lot is that there might be this huge need for certain expertise or specialty. Mm-hmm. There isn't the infrastructure in the country to provide that expertise. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you have any comments on supporting the university in academia within the international setting.
Yeah.
No,
I agree with you. That's hugely important. As I was leaving USAID, I know there was under development I don't know what it was going to end up being called, and maybe it's been launched. It was sort of the equivalent of an innovation lab for capacity building. And USAID over the years, I think, has tried out many different things in the capacity building space. And there's it's not an easy nut to crack. And I think the work that the innovation labs have been doing, which partners U.S. universities with universities overseas, I think has been hugely important, but often in a limited sense focused on that university or the researchers they're working with, and hasn't necessarily been focused on systemically changing how a university overseas might conduct its business, rewriting its entire curriculums, or thinking about the degree programs it's offering. And so I know that this new project was really thinking about how do you work with institutions like that to really fundamentally change how they do business and bring them up and help them sort of assess the landscape, figure out what's needed in their country, and offer the training that is appropriate to the need. So I agree with you, that's a huge area of need. I think there's a lot of very innovative and cool ways of doing that that people are trying out. I don't know that we've solved it and or done it at scale yet. I know Ohio State University was working with our USAID mission in Tanzania on the IAGRI program, and they were doing a version of that. And it really, every you know, I visited their project once, and everything I heard about that was really interesting, the way they were just taking these two universities and working across all aspects of university operations. Because sometimes it's not so much the training of the curriculum, it might just be the fundamental operations of that university. How do they have the right financial systems in place? Do they have systems to attract and retain the right kind of student? Or do they know how to write grants and get funding outside of what they may be getting from the government? So things that don't, you know, aren't the most interesting part of a university's operations, perhaps, but are really some of the most fundamental in order to help those institutions really serve their country to meet that need, because it's absolutely critical.